I do train for that. Okay, so we're recording now. It's the Wednesday, September 2nd, 2015. We'll meet for the Developmental Disabilities Advisory Board. Getting started. 5:20-ish. Is there any community input? Okay, then we move on to Mona Forsnell, and she has information about the Developmental Disabilities Council Community Access Work Group.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I was invited to come and just share a little bit about what this work group's been doing. I don't have any handouts because we don't have anything final yet. We're just in discussion. This community access work group was formed by the DD Council in response, sort of, to the new IFS waiver and some of the legislative decisions that were made, but really in response to some things we were hearing from families trying to use community access and having a difficult time and having it be very robust or having it work very well for them. And so we thought we'd explore that and what that actually meant, or what whether it was just anecdotal or what was really going on. So the community access work group is made up primarily of parents. There's a county representative from, I think,
Grace Harbor.
Thank you. A couple of ARC from Tri-Cities, and there's Debbie from DDA, the Office of DDA is there as well in those conversations. And so the beginning conversations were really to talk about the way that our Employment First initiative, which sets us up for 9 months of exploring employment and then the opportunity to access community access if that's not successful, in some people's minds makes it sort of community engagement, community access be a stepchild to employment. Everybody recognizes that employment is absolutely primary and paramount, and that nobody wants any of that to go away. However, there's some concern about making the community access, community engagement piece more robust and more, and actually just more useful for people and fewer barriers. We don't seem to have too much information from counties that there are a lot of barriers reported by families. And so that was part of the reason we wanted to have the discussion, because it seemed like we were hearing it from families, but we weren't really hearing it from counties, and they're not hearing it from families. So it's confusing. And so we had initially looked at all of the waivers, what kind of services were provided, what the community access rules and regulations are, how it's set up, what the system is, and then we dreamed a little bit. What would we like to see? What might be a way to have a more meaningful use of community access kinds of things? What kind of things would we like to have in it? And what might it look like? And some of the things that we came up in that process were community engagement, not just access, but community engagement, peer mentoring, really person-centered planning, facilitation, and a whole piece about assistive technology and that we feel like might be important for that. And so we looked at lots of definitions, we looked at lots of resources, and most recently talked about also adding a piece that really looks maybe at aging and health and nutrition and some of those active, healthy aging kind of pieces as well. Because I have learned a lot about it, but the Community Access Project program is really for those who've not employed, tried employment, are not employed, or for those who are senior citizens over the age of 62. And we really didn't have activities or access around or thinking about healthy aging, and so that's why that most recently has kind of been thrown into the discussion as well. And so it's become clear to me that some of what focus and direction of the discussions has been guided towards discussion around self-directed services. I'm not sure where that's going, but it's part of the conversation, self-directed services. I know we've had conversation about pulling some of the things that are out of other waivers and maybe creating a whole new waiver. The DDA is absolutely up to their ears in planning and working on the most recent changes the legislature approved, and the new IFS waiver, and getting more case managers involved. And so it's not on their radar in the near future. So I think we're talking about something where really active discussions are really going to be talked about in 2 or 3 years down the road, if in terms of any kind of a new waiver to talk about self-directed services, which would allow families to make the choices about where and how those dollars are spent. So we've had 5 meetings. We've got a number of more meetings scheduled. We've been meeting every 3 weeks or so, and then we'll create a kind of a summary of what we've done and what we think and what we're recommending, and that'll go then on to counties and DDA for input, and then we'll continue. So that conversation is going on. If you have input, please give it to me. If you have questions, I'll try and answer them. We have another meeting next Wednesday. I came and talked with Mary and Trish a couple weeks ago and said, I'm really confused about some of these pieces. Help me understand it so that I could help. This is one of my final chores or tasks or projects, I guess, on the DD Council. I've been on it for 6 years. My last meeting would be this month, but I'm going to be on a business trip, so I'm not going to be able to make it. So I've really enjoyed it, and I really appreciate your support and encouragement and the partnership with the county staff and so forth. As I've been doing this the last 6 years, I think we've gained a lot. I know I've grown tremendously through that process. I know we had some local people who applied. I'm not sure whether I'm being replaced by someone from our area of the state or not. We had 24 people apply for 2 open positions, which is tremendous interest, and we're thrilled by that uptick. I'm not sure what to attribute it to, but that uptick in applications to be on the council, and that we've heard from multiple directions that this is the strongest council we've had in years. So I feel good about that. Sad to be leaving, but I'll bring my energy back to the county now instead of at the state level. So do you have any questions about that, or if you have directives for me, I'd be happy to take them and throw them into that complicated mix of conversations we're having.
Does any of the conversation center around transitioning from school into the workplace, or you mentioned employment first?
The only piece that really has included that transition piece has been, as we've been talking about, someone brought up the idea, well, do they really have to try employment? And they were about run out of the room because we all said we're a people first, we're an employment first state, and absolutely everyone needs to try employment first. And then we had discussion about, instead of just 9 months, maybe it ought to be more like 2 years, because people take a long time to get into their profession and they need more support for a longer time. And so that's a conversation that I'm hoping to push a little bit more in terms of, and we have some great stories about, my son is one, about a time it took 2 to 3 years for that employment to come about, but it's grown and blossomed as a huge success, but it would never have happened in 9 months. So that's the direction I'd like the conversations to go, but we've not really talked specifically about transition to community access, transition to employment, or any of those pieces other than that. And it was sort of resoundingly affirmed that everyone needs to try employment first, and preferably for longer.
When employment, when those regs were written and changed so that you needed to try this for 9 months, it takes someone without a disability longer than 9 months typically to get a job. So we're really holding people to a different standard than is typical.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of speed of getting a job, and hopefully we're not doing that at the expense of a quality job,
mm-hmm.
and a good job match.
So what is it? Do you have a number? I just picked 2 years out of hat, but I'd be interested in having a good number to advocate for, as opposed to just I think it ought to be 2 years. No,
I think that's, we should look at our data, because we came through a really bad economic time, and then nationally, because we get a lot of criticism about hours, and I'm right there saying people need more hours, but people at the lower end of the workforce across the board are getting fewer hours than they did pre-recession. And those are articles I can't think of.
Yeah. I'd like to have that, because I think that's one of the conversations that will come out of this discussion, will be that conversation about that employment requirement. And really, are we putting people, as Mary said, at a disadvantage because we only have 9 months? Would they be more employed and with more hours if they had longer to develop the supports and develop that job base? I think we need to start having that conversation.
I think some of the two-hour jobs that were gotten in Seattle were probably because there was that brief window when coming out of school, you had to have a job or you couldn't get any service. Mm-hmm. So when developmental disabilities said, it didn't matter how much somebody worked. There were some very clever agencies that quick got people 2-hour jobs.
And they're still working at 2 hours.
Well, unfortunately, they probably are, but then nationally, they want to point to Washington and say, oh, everybody's got 2-hour jobs. That's not true. But there was that window that in order to get any service at all, you'd take anything. And I don't blame families that took that.
Mm-hmm.
I think they did the right thing.
So. Part of my reason for asking is I had an interesting experience this week. I went to a meeting for Special Olympics, and there were some young people sitting there talking, and one of them said something. Apparently they were just leaving school, graduated or whatever, and one of them talked about, They didn't like transition. They thought it was boring and blah blah blah, and the other one kind of agreed with that. And so I asked them. I said, "So, don't you have any goals for wanting to get a job and to work?" it wasn't too encouraging to me. And I'm thinking, so are they? If they just don't do anything, are they just going to end up on welfare and we're going to take care of them that way? Or, what's the incentive other than, what is the incentive, I guess, for those? Now, we didn't have to do anything to incentivize David. he was the one that was pushing for getting a job, but it just made me think, I bet there are a lot who, maybe from the family they come from or from whatever, do we have something that incentivizes them to...
Do you know what school district?
No idea.
There we go.
An exasperating
My guess is there's probably a 90% chance it was either Evergreen or Vancouver.
Okay, well, I'm meeting with them next week.
Just funny. I think it's interesting, as a parent of a person who just turned 24, so he's recently out of that. We're recently out of through that process of transitioning. I think it's interesting that it'd be interesting to have a conversation more about dreaming, about for our students with intellectual and developmental disabilities to be dreaming about their future. And really to be exploring or dreaming about where they could go. I think dreaming is something we don't encourage. It's really not something in the repertoire or the experience of people with disabilities through their school. Everything is planned and programmed and regimented, and dreaming is something they're not practiced at, and so it's difficult then when you begin to talk about what do you want your future to look like or where do you want to work, especially when we might be so concrete. It's just not an easy thing to bridge that chasm. And I know Darla can speak to this better than I can. We have a group of young adults in Clark County, and that's one of the directions I'm going to be putting my energy now that I'm not on the DD Council. And this is not a DD Council thing. It's a Clark County, Darla and I brainstorming kind of. There's a large group of young adults in that 21 to 30 age group who are looking for things to do, who are not actively engaged in the community and community engagement or in employment. They're casting about for what to do. And we have some interest in starting a new People First chapter. I'd love to see some advocacy so that they can begin to think about advocating for themselves and dreaming about what they might do to contribute to this community. And that's what we're working on, and we've had initial conversations, and once I wrap up this DD Council stuff, that's where my energy will go. So. I'm really right there with you. I think that that transition needs to include that piece so that people can have can learn how to dream about what a future might look like that exists with things that they've not experienced.
In terms of the question of transition and household, the adult, I mean, services, the vendors, and that we have the knowledge, and somehow we need to take that more actively to the public schools, mm-hmm. and to the classrooms 18 to 21. It would be really great if every vendor in Clark County was working with a, you know, a school district and assisting them with transitioning in that 18 to 21 year old group.
So, David, there currently, from your perspective, there's no interface between the transition programs and employment programs?
There's some, and certainly, I don't know that much about GATE,
right.
and
mm-hmm.
you know, I know that we've been active with Canvas School District, and before that with Washougal, and I would say 10% of our individuals that are currently in jobs in our program started as activity that we had in high school,
mm-hmm.
18 to 21. So it's certainly possible, like this year we're working with Canvas and we have two students that are graduating that are employed. And I think it's certainly possible to have, for adult services to have more of an impact on what's going on in that 18 to 21. And there's certainly enough need to go around in terms of the number of vendors.
Is there a reason why, if that's, from my perspective at least, that seems to me be very logical, and I'm kind of surprised that it isn't natural progression, whether or not it's Vancouver School District, Evergreen School District, Canvas School District, that isn't, you know, a cornerstone of transition is the interactions with either, you know, the vendors or with DVR or those kinds of things.
Hi, I'm Helen Christensen. I'm from DVR, counselor from DVR. Personally, my own experience is that I'm sitting on the board of the Evergreen School District Transitional Advisory Board, and throughout the school year, we have very close contact with the coordinator, Joyce Scully. Yeah. We go to the meeting and we are present in any family information night, a round table discussion. So we're out there in terms of letting them know what service is out there for them, especially those in transition program. These are the 18 to 21 population. So we're in close contact with them. So we also go to IEP meeting for those not in the transition yet. And we also, myself, because I am the liaison for the Evergreen School District, we're also in close contact in the 504 program. So we try to be there and educate, well, not educate, but let them know what we can do in terms of service that they're, you know, that's available to their kids. I think that the problem will be that our words are still not reaching, the information is not reaching to the parents and the students. So my thinking is that if we can educate or at least inform the teacher, especially the special aid teacher, what's available, maybe they will be able to pass it on to the family and that the service will be utilized more fully.
One of the things I really think is that as you're raising your children, employment starts at 6 months. It doesn't start with transition.
Mm-hmm.
It starts at crawl over there and get your diaper,
mm-hmm.
right? And so expecting a family or an individual that has never had those expectations or a family that didn't have the and I'm going to say permission to dream of a future. To start doing that, a transition is a little late. We really have to hit those birth to three families and those 3 to 5 families. And that it's critical that that is where we start employment, or they're not going to be ready at 18 or 21 or 25.
And I think you have to craft the language enough that it's accessible to someone. So a parent of a preschooler or a 6-month-old is going to say employment. Yeah. But if you talk about life dreaming or dreaming for the future, they can get their mind around that a little bit easier than employment when your kid's a year old. I think we have to be careful about the language, and then it's easier to sell. And then people are easier to engage in the conversation.
Well, it's even talking to families about, to me, that young, about what they can contribute at home.
Yeah.
Because if they're contributing there, that is a step in the direction.
Well, and what I found when I was in the high school program was that so many families are surviving today, that they hear all this stuff and it's like, yeah, I kind of remember something about that. But until school actually goes away, and here's September, and it's like, oh yeah, there was that thing, that person, and that, oh, I can't remember. And it just, life just happens like that. But it seems like probably half of my families were just trying to figure out how they were going to get through the week.
Yeah.
And with,
oh, yeah,
with this child that's complicated, right, and resources, right, and supports, yeah, and everything else, that the notion of, oh yeah, and then in 3 years I'm going to contact this person at DVR that's going to get me hooked up with this person at Employment Overload, you're like, it's not there. And so it's just reaccessing that information or knowing who to reach out to.
David, do something a little bit different with Washougal and Canvas, because you actually work with the people, the students, when they're still in school,
yeah,
right?
We no longer work with Washougal, but we're still working with 18 to 21.
Yeah, and that's a contract, right, with Canvas?
With,
yeah,
yeah,
and
yeah,
probably it's one of, probably the only place in the state,
yeah, yeah,
where the school district is paid for that in, yeah, lieu of some things. There are some union issues with some of the other districts in freeing up funds to send to the agencies. Some counties have been able to figure out money to, along with VR, to pay this, but you have to have enough front end money. You have to be in large enough county to be able to move money around to get that to happen. Because
that, I mean, that's the real connection. And you know, because I would talk as well as Susan, do your blue in the face, but to have that person be in this, not only a conversation, but participating because there's money behind it, that's huge. Which is why it works well for kids.
We can do things, the vendors can do things,
right,
that the school districts can't.
Yeah.
We're open 24/7.
Yep.
So we can do things on the weekends. We can transport people to interviews. We can do job development and a lot of things that the school district really isn't used to doing unless they're a big social team. I mean, that's why we're at Canvas and not like Evergreen or Vancouver, because they have bigger programs that are doing stuff.
They do, but it's still, I think what you're doing is so helpful because you've already made those connections, and when school's out, you're not going away.
Right.
And that's the thing. Even all of the other transition programs, when they're done, those people go away. And yet, in Canvas, you've made that connection, and so it's much more solid.
It would be something to work toward with all the school districts.
That could be part, yeah, of our school district presentation when we start talking to them.
Yeah, because we do, yeah, the family training series every year. You know, starts in October and ends in May. And families get a lot of information. Employment is a big part of it, not all of it. But everybody's said a lot of pieces of truth. And there's a lot of information to take in.
And, I mean, just another point is we're motivated to do it, not only because we like doing it, but we're motivated because over the years, students have moved from us having that relationship with them in high school to becoming our customers as adults. And that's been very beneficial to our program.
Have we sent out special invitations to the special ed directors of all the school districts for next month's event?
I forwarded it to Evergreen School Districts. I mentioned it at the roundtable because last year the same roundtable that Helen was talking about, and that is there was a conflict last year and they had a meeting on the same date and time, so I'm sure that they knew before the end of the school year that we would ask that they maybe take a field trip instead of having that meeting to come and see, so that the people planning transition to Evergreen School District come to our event.
And I'm going to be in Evergreen in Vancouver next week, next Wednesday, and drop some off to...
It just seems kind of makes sense, you know. Here's something that you may want to enjoy the celebration.
We could, no, I can go anywhere. We could invite Grace and Joyce to the DDAB. It's probably been a while since they've come and...
Not before the event.
No, not before the event, but just to talk about transition in general.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, good idea. And maybe Denny too, from Africa. I have to meet him. Do you know him?
Not yet.
I think it's also important to share stories. I think parents relate to a story of a family's journey to through all of that. And while they'll hear these foreign concepts or they'll hear about providers and they'll wonder what that all means, they can follow a story of a family on that journey and some parts of it will resonate. And then they'll be able to begin to say, plug their own child or their own family into pieces of that story and begin to think beyond that. And I don't think we do a good job of that at all, period. I don't think. The DD Council tries with their Informing Families Building Trust website and some stories on that, but I think we don't do a good job of that, and I think that that's another real accessible, relatable way for families to begin to think about some of these things in the midst of the chaos and the just getting through the week stuff, to begin to think about and see, oh, here's a family who's similar in these ways, or not similar in these ways, but here's the journey they've had and look where they are. Isn't that interesting? And begin to have them begin to have those. And I think that's something we could do way better. I don't know how, but the vehicles are. But I really think there's some great stories that are really easy to resonate with people. And we should figure out a way to do that.
Well, and
whatever that is.
Mary, maybe you can, it's been a while, but WISE, I think it's not a family story, but it's the employment story, right? Don't they have on YouTube, doesn't WISE have
a lot
a catalog
of, they have a lot
of people at work,
yeah,
showing them at their job every county.
Great, and so do the families know to access that website to hear those stories?
See, yeah,
that's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah. WISE is here, so let's ask.
Okay.
So anyway, that all began as the community access work group.
Good job.
Do I have any comments or questions or anything you direct me to do in the next few months?
Thank you for
being here. Absolutely. My pleasure. I really have enjoyed everything I've done with that council. And
Mona's been outstanding, representing Southwest Washington. It's her voice and reasonableness and rational.
It's important to forget that we're down here.
If we don't have someone from, I mean, I don't know who's been appointed, so if there's not somebody, you can be sure. They've said, well, the meetings are public. I said, you'll see me if there's not anyone in this area. You know, I'll stay connected. I have unfinished projects anyway, so.
Well, I think if you're talking about telling a story, I think an important part of that story is the individual who's working and the enjoyment they get out of it, mm-hmm. and what they can do because of the monies they earn. And those kinds of things, you want to speak to the
personal satisfaction.
To the person who's got the disability and mm-hmm. help them to realize, oh, I don't have to just sit home and play my games. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe that's all they want to do, but they can do so many other things because of the job, and they can do something that they enjoy doing.
And training series has a piece, like a panel piece, that seems to be along those lines.
I think the conversation that I've had with Darla and probably others gazillions of times over the past few years is just that, what Mona was saying, that dream piece. Mm-hmm. Because the families that come to those events, that's great. And the families that come to these, and the families that find that website on WISE's website, that's not the bulk of them. The bulk of them are in crisis or hidden under a rock somewhere, and it's really hard to reach those families. We've done it. We've created this group through the Evergreen School District, the roundtable, where people would have access to the administration, special services, and you know, only so many people would come. A lot of times, it was the same people and the same small group. And things just go by the wayside when there's not that large outpouring or seeking of information. And I think it goes all the way back to what Mona was saying, mm-hmm. of that kind of a cultural, it's a mama and papa bear parent thing. We're going to protect our child. Mm-hmm. He or she may or may not be able to do this. No, they could never do that. Or when they think of a job, they may think of their own or people they know, and they can't foresee the kinds of jobs that are created or the job carving that goes on in the community. So they can't, they don't dream that way. They don't have that vision. And then the kids are raised in a household without that vision. That was not mine. That was not mine personally. So my poor children were, you know, not coddled hardly whatsoever. My son was like, "Mom, can you get me this? Get me a drink or whatever." It's like, "No, get up, get it yourself." that sort of independence piece I've been teaching since the diagnosis came at 2, for then both of my children. But that, and I am an information seeker, so I would connect to a board like this. Or the groups that Darla runs through the Parent Coalition, or I've met Huna in SEPSA and other. But it's this large, 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 large piece of our community that doesn't get connected and outreach. I think the schools are probably our best bet, but
younger than high school.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yes.
Because when I look at the data, it's the 4 to 17 year olds that our data says we're missing. Mm-hmm. We have 20,000 more people in our community and 7 fewer people registered with DDA. And that where we're down is the 4 to 17 year olds. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking those elementary 3 to maybe 12 year olds in particular. And reaching down as far as we can.
It takes a vision. When I worked for Vancouver, because when I got into this transition stuff in 89, came from when we went to the University of Washington, and I went back and I said, we need to do this starting in, you know, preschool, and they're just, oh, sure. But I feel like it's come full circle, and you have to, you know, not the whole thing, but you've got to start the bits and pieces, otherwise it is overwhelming, you know?
Work.
So there's lots of work to do.
Work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mom. Our second is public sector supported employment, and we have Wendy
And just to segue, I think another way that we can help with expectations and with dreaming is that we see more people out there with jobs. So. I'm going to be talking about public sector, and right now there's 4 jobs identified, and I'm just going to give you a brief overview of the 4. And the first one is with the Department for Community Services. There's an office age paid position, 20 hours. It's all good to go. We're just waiting for the last reference, and then we're going to have a job start set up. So that whole process has happened, job analysis, the onboarding discussions, and the interviews, and there were about 20 applicants and 8 that they actually went through an interview process with. And it was really hard. I didn't have a vote in it, but I mean, the panel that did the interviewing, it was very, very difficult because there were a lot of wonderful candidates. So that's where that one is. The next one, we've been working with HR, and they identified, we kind of went in and, you know, they were hoping for a 20-hour position, and we just, right now, we don't see the tasks, so we see a 10-hour position. But we want a 20-hour position. And so we've also been working with the board of counselors, and they've got about 10 hours there. So we're just starting a conversation about putting those two together and making a 20-hour position. They're both departments are on board. It takes a little while because they're two very different departments, very different tasks, cultures, et cetera. So we're trying to figure out how to blend it, how it's going to look in terms of the position. But that's going to probably be the next one that will be rolling out. And I think at this point, every place so far has been approved by the counselors, but the
they
board
are.
Yeah. So it will. It should be not hanging us up.
Right.
So then the third one is the IT department, and that's just started. And they were hoping for a 40-hour position. We're in there right now. Ryan Farrell is doing that job analysis, and you know, it looks like maybe 20 to maybe 30 hours. We think there's more, but it takes a while sometimes to pull it out. They're restructuring, and there's some stuff going on there. So it'll be at least 20, but hopefully more, and maybe we can build on that. And then the last one is the operations, and they've got a 20-hour position approved. They were hoping for 40 also, and so we're going to try to set it up so that we can add to that, because right now they only have a 20-hour position approved. But they came with a full agenda. They know what they want. They want a forklift, somebody who can drive a forklift. So it's very different where the other ones are all office. The board and the HR are filing and office work and also scanning and a lot of data entry for that one, so it's a more complex position. And since it's in two very separate, distinct departments, there's just a little level of complexity there. But that's kind of where they're at right now, and I plan on, as soon as we get that job start, it should be tomorrow. we'll get the date tomorrow. And then I'll set up for the HR and the board counselors to get their timeline in for pulling people in for interviews. So we've already got a pool. These are pooled positions for the office pieces. And so we know there's seven more really good candidates, and we'll put it out there again so that we can get even more. That's kind of it in a real quick nutshell. Is there anything, any questions or anything? I'm hoping to get more than four. So we're just still talking. So Michael Fish, he's with the treasurer's department, not letting that go, and so we're still going to be talking to whoever will talk to us and see if we can get some more. It'd be lovely if we could get more.
Is it nearly double, like Mr.
Yes.
McCauley
promised?
Four doubles it?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, good.
They won't have started, not everybody, but everybody's going to be approved. It's
yeah.
in process, and so he can safely say there are four new jobs.
Awesome. And we haven't circled back to the prosecutor because I think they're doing as much as they can, as fast as they can.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
I was wondering, the county is having some sort of a call for volunteers for some sort of an inclusion
event.
What?
Yeah,
okay,
the newsletter came out, the FYI, I was reading the FYI from the other day, and it said something about they needed volunteers for this Pacific Northwest.
The Diversity Conference.
Mm-hmm. In their diversity, or are they including disability in their diversity conference?
I just
wondered. You did? Okay, well, good. I just wondered, as I saw that call for volunteers, whether disability was...
Well, that's newer to them, safe to say. But Harold is on the committee, and he's been our finance manager, and he's trying to make sure that disability gets included in that. If you haven't been, those of you who work for the county, you know, it's actually a really good conference. I was surprised last year. And if you volunteer, your department doesn't have to pay.
Oh,
yeah. So, good to know, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Wendy.
You're welcome.
Well, that one is not here.
Okay. So Michael's not here for the ARC update, but Darla's
not. Mm-hmm. Do you want anything from me? Mm-hmm. I'm not technically ARC.
No.
Okay, thank you.
We won't put you on the hot seat.
Well, maybe I can make a comment. I would never, ever claim to stand in for my group, but the ARC has obtained money and has hired a housing coordinator, and that is going to develop, it's just starting out, they're going to be developing this position, and the idea is to be able to help families who are families with persons with disability in their search for housing, and just looking at all of the options and working with the Vancouver Housing Authority, working with whatever means possible to be able to open up more opportunities for people who are looking for housing for their children. And I think it's a wonderful thing that and the ARC has hired this person. And they'll be working closely with Mike Piper because he has a lot of experience in that area. We met with him Monday night, and it was very encouraging.
Mr. Antelope, didn't he come to our...
No, he's there's a new person.
He was in that position in, I think, 2 days, two or 3 days.
Oh, okay. So that was...
Someone new.
Yeah.
No.
Her name is Jennifer Mathias.
She's a graduate of our leadership development program through the Parent Coalition. And she's amazing, so we're very excited to have her on board. She's a mom, and she's got that passion to just go make this happen.
Thank you, Mike.
That's good news.
All of us, all of those of us who are connected with this are extremely grateful to Clark County and Mary's department for the grant money that was given to make this available, possible. Thank you.
Just getting ready for the transit update.
Yeah, what I have here for you is some information about the Vine. The Vine is the bus rapid transit that will be operating from Vancouver Mall to downtown Vancouver starting in late 2016. And I was fortunate enough last guest list.
What is bus rapid transit?
Oh, okay. Bus rapid transit is similar to light rail in the respect that it is able to transport many, many, many people quickly and efficiently, but you don't have the infrastructure of rail and rail stations and all those kinds of things. In some ways, it's like light rail on rubber tires. And as a matter of fact, when the whole debate about light rail and the bridge and all those kinds of things were being debated in our community, one of the things that was interesting is that the people that didn't seem to like light rail seemed to like bus rapid transit because it could be moved from one particular route to another one very easily. And so what we decided to do was minimize our costs with light rail by only having light rail come up to Clark College and then using bus rapid transit as a means to get people from that point to Vancouver Mall and then distributing people from stations along the pathway. One of the key elements of bus rapid transit is the fact that it has level boarding platforms. One of the problems that we have, and if you've ever been on the fourth plane bus, or any of our buses, even with ramps rather than lifts, is that the amount of time that a bus waits to board a person in a mobility device, whether or not that mobility device is a cane or a walker or a wheelchair or a scooter, delays the process. And in delaying the process, depending upon when that person decides to ride or not, makes the system a little bit less reliable. The problem is that the victims are those people that are trying to access their bus system, their transit system, that happen to use mobility devices. And those people that are ambulatory get rather frustrated and angry that they're slowing things down and I'm not going to be able to get to my connection as quick as possible and those kinds of things. And so, as a side note, when we do travel training, a lot of times when we're doing travel training with a person that has a mobility device, we'll have them practice with one of our buses in a non-stressful situation so that the pressures of trying to perform as quickly as possible as to not frustrate the other passengers isn't there. With bus rapid transit, because it's a level boarding, we will go from a 2 to 5 minute dwell time or waiting time to 30 seconds. And that's because the person will be on the same level as the bus. When the bus comes up, and it's a 60-foot articulated bus, so it has capacity for upwards to 80 to 90 people, the ramp slides out about 18 inches to reach where the edge of the curb is, and the person gets on board. And because with bus rapid transit, we're going to offer the ability of a person, if they wanted to ride in a passive restraint system rather than an active securement system, they can. And if they choose to make that choice, then the amount of time we're at the station and boarding people would be less than 30 seconds. The advantage of that is it makes it more reliable. When it's more reliable and a person says, oh, they're here right when they said they were going to be here, more and more people use it. When I'm talking about the passive restraint system, the passive restraint system is a very interesting one. If you can imagine that you're in a mobility device, and let's say, as an example, I'm in a mobility device right now, excuse me, and the bus is going this direction. You'll notice that on securement areas, it's up against it's called a privacy screen, right behind the driver, and an entrance screen right there. And so you can't go any further than that. So what they've done with passive restraint is they've created on a padded area that is formed right here so that you can take your mobility device, put it up against it, an arm comes down, you're off and running. There's no securements to the wheelchair or to the mobility device. If it stops, you go up against something that's a fixed object, which is the privacy screen that has the pad on it. If you're making a turn, if you do have a tendency to lean, you're coming up against an arm here or against the side of the bus here. Bus rapid transit uses a passive restraint system up in Snohomish County Community Transit. And under the ADA, excuse me, the transit authority is required to offer both forward-facing and rear-facing, but they have to definitely offer forward-facing, at least one of the two securement areas. In the 6 years that Community Transit's bus rapid transit has been in effect, they've had only two people request the forward-facing. The reason being is that the independence of an individual in a mobility device coming up to the passive restraint system, the arm comes down, holds him in place. They feel perfectly secure. And they can get on and get off as quickly as a person that doesn't use a mobility device. You're seeing that also with regular buses up in Snohomish County with community transit too as well, is that it's so popular that, you know, people really like the convenience and ease of it all. And here's the interesting part of it all. The Washington State Transit Insurance Pool, which is transits other than Seattle Metro, because they're so big, is the insurance companies for all transits in the state of Washington. And they reported, last week we had a state conference, they reported they have not had one incident on community transit's program for the last 6 years involving a wheelchair. So not only is it a convenient choice that a person can have, it's also a safe choice as well, as demonstrated by the fact of 6 years worth of history and not one accident at all. And so with bus rapid transit, to answer your question, is we can board onto the bus quickly and get it moving as quickly as possible. And it can transport upwards of 90 people at one single time. The stops for bus rapid transit aren't as close as some stops are. And that's, again, to be able to get transit, to be able to compete with those in a vehicle. Because once you can compete effectively with a person that chooses a vehicle, a personal vehicle, they can start making the choice saying, well, wait a minute, why should I do this when it's going to get me there just as fast, and I don't have to pay insurance, I don't have to pay as much gas, I don't have the hassles of it all, and you know what, I can save the environment a little bit. So that's one of the underlying features behind bus rapid transit. Here in Clark County, you'll see a description of what the information, you know, describes a bit. But one of the things is Mary and Trish and I were at the grand opening at Turtle Place, which is down on 7th Street near Washington, is that when you look at the back page, you'll see the timeline, and you'll see what some of the stations will look like. Of the money that is being used to build bus rapid transit here in Clark County, the majority of the $53 million that's going to be used, only 14% of that money comes from Clark County. So 86% comes from either the federal government or from the Washington state. And if you look right where it says project funding on the first page on the lower right-hand side, you'll see that federal funding is 80%, 6% from the state, and then 14% from us here in Clark County. We have that money set aside because we set aside money. One of the things, if you don't know about C-Train, is we're a pay-as-we-go system. A lot of transits throughout the United States finance the purchase of buses, finance capital improvements, and they float bonds. You know, and people buy those bonds, and in turn, that helps finance the organization. C-Tran, from the very beginning, has been a pay-as-we-go. So we set aside money for future use because we don't want to have to pay the interest that a bond would require, and we want to be able to be good stewards of the taxpayers' dollars. That's one thing that came up probably about 5-6 years ago, people saying, well, look, C-Tran has $70 million in reserves. Well, okay, so let's take a step back. Let's say you decided that you wanted to pay cash for your house, because we all know that if you buy a mortgage for your house, you're not going to pay just what the asking price is. You're going to pay that and about a third more in interest. How about we take a unique approach, a very fiscally conservative approach, and say, hey, listen, let's set aside money until we have enough, and then we purchase these vehicles. Then we build this program. Let's leverage that money, because we have it in hand, with grants that the federal government and the state government have, so we can stretch our dollars. So the bind is really the the culmination of a very fiscally conservative approach. And what's interesting about this is the fact that when the Vine is up and running and the bus rapid transit, it's so much more efficient. Because keep in mind, what really is the major expense of public transit isn't the vehicle, isn't the gasoline or diesel, it is the individuals that operate the vehicles. So if you can cut down the number of people needed to provide transit, you're saving money. In this particular case, in 5 years, the money, the 14% local that we are setting aside to initiate this, will be recouped. And so on a return on investment, I don't know, Dell, you're more of a finance kind of guy, but if I was in business and you tell me that if I could borrow this money and that by borrowing this money in 5 years, I'll be able to recoup that expense and then in turn be able to spend that savings for additional service, I'm going to say that's a pretty doggone big deal. And that's why we're doing it. It's a way to not only to expand service, make service more reliable so it competes with regular cars, but it also is a good fiscal approach that says we're going to be able to save money by doing this so that we can redirect some of the money we already use for the fourth plane route to other routes to be able to expand, to be able to pay for C-band service, which seems to be growing by leaps and bounds. But it was really exciting to see the groundbreaking that wasn't really a groundbreaking. It was more of a banner unfurling. You know, I was kind of looking for a jackhammer or two, but it didn't really.
It was a banner unfurling.
Yeah. And one of the things, too, is that it's an economic development. That's part of the reason why the federal government likes these kind of projects, which is the largest economic development project on a fourth plane corridor ever, which is one of our more economically depressed areas, we'll be able to enhance it so that maybe those businesses along the fourth plane corridor will be more vibrant, maybe bring in more businesses, be able to serve more people. Unfortunately, the Chevys that's along the corridor has just been torn down, and so you won't be able to have that as a meeting place. But it's gonna be an exciting time. Darla and I were talking about if creating like a coffee shop hanging out area along the bus rapid transit.
I was checking out locations.
And she was checking out the old Chevys. Okay.
Okay.
And
I thought Clark College was
there. Yeah, the next thing I knew, I'm looking at this Robles. I'm going home. I'm going, oh, well, she's not going to do it there. inside your packet is a nice little sticker. I recommend that you put that on your car so that later on, when you're not using your car, you'll know what you'll be using, which is the
Vine. You should put it over your ignition.
There's also a card right here, construction hotline. And the construction hotline will be able to tell you as we start breaking ground. And the first ground that we'll be breaking is our own, which is at C-Tran headquarters. We're going to be expanding the garage. So we can accommodate these 60-foot long articulated buses. Right now we don't have the maintenance bays in order to work on those. And as we get closer to deployment of this, we'll also be having Veronica and the travel training team working with our travel ambassadors, some of whom I'm looking at right now, with intent desire, that will be helping customers learn how to use the Vine. And so it's going to be exciting times. It's going to be real messy for the next 18 months, but it's really an exciting time to finally get Clark County into the 21st century. Yeah?
Is Vine an acronym for something? or if not, did the name?
You know, I don't know how it actually came about. I actually wanted to call it Bob. You know, I like Bob. Anybody I can't remember the name, I call him Bob. There's a couple of drivers. I just can't remember the name, I call him Bob.
They didn't like my idea. This name was the product of citizen input and type of thing. And I think because the way it binds down for playing out.
Sounds good.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
It's
there's an
actor
in
there. Some of that can come out. Well, yeah, volunteer and year excursion.
Innovative, nutty. No, is fourth plane like the major?
Fourth plane uses up 40% of all of our resources. Fourth plane route transports by far and away the most number of people. It utilizes about 40% of our operational funds.
Wow.
And so that's the reason why it was chosen. Someday in the future, you may have a vine that goes down Middle Plain, which is our second busiest one. Now, what will happen is the vine will terminate at Turtle Place, and then a shuttle bus will go over to Jansen Beach and Delta Park using a conventional bus. The vine will be hybrid technology, so it will have minimal emissions and stuff like that. And it's going to be fully accessible, and I hope to see a lot of my C-Van customers using that instead of C-Van, because it's going to be so much easier to use. The Transit Center will be relocated from the north side of Vancouver Mall to the south side. So if you look at Sears on the south side, where that big huge sign for Cinetopia is, that's where the new Transit Center is going to be.
Awesome.
There'll be a pathway made from there to the mall, but the northern side transit center will be replaced with the southern. Any questions about that? I have one other thing I wanted to go over with the group. Your mesmerizing power.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was actually a lot of fun to go to the grand opening. Or the start of this, the planting of the vine, so to speak. The other thing is that earlier day there was an email that was sent out by DREED, Dread, or whatever.
No, it was forwarded from the Governor's Committee on Disability and Employment.
Right.
That's who sent it out to the world.
There's a circular going around by the Department of Transportation and Federal Transit Administration, FTA, about a possible rule changing with regards to the fare that people are charged or can be charged on ADA paratransit, C-Van, TriMet Lift. When the ADA was first implemented, the rule said that the transit authority could charge up to twice of the fare that is collected on fixed route. So if the fare on fixed route is $1, the ADA paratransit individual could be charged upwards to $2 for that trip. Here in Clark County, we've always made it the same as what we call the C zone or Clark County zone. And I don't see any changes to that in the future. We offer some degree of a discount by means of the pass. I mean, we have an encouragement for folks that are disabled that can use this route through the Honored Citizen Pass and Ticket Program that they can save 50% of the cost if they use fixed route rather than paratransit. And I just wanted to try to explain why this is being raised at this point in time. To kind of give you a perspective, right now, the cost per passenger boarding on fixed route here in Clark County at C-Tran is approximately $450 to $475 per time they board. So every time that a person boards the fixed route bus system, it costs C-Tran $4.50. The customers or the passengers pay $1.80. You can see it's still highly subsidized through our sales tax revenue. Most all of the revenue that we get is through sales taxes. There isn't a big, huge federal infusion of dollars. There's a very minor amount of state dollars that are given, but by and far it's local sales tax revenue. And that's the reason why we've come to you in the past. C-VAN, on the other hand, currently the cost per passenger boarding is $37.50. So you can see the difference. And part of it is the fact that with fixed route, you can transport more people simultaneously because you have larger vehicles. They're going down a fixed guideway, so there is a diluting of cost because of that. Whereas with C-VAN, my program, we go into the neighborhoods and we pick up 1, 2, 3 individuals. At times, we may pick up 12, 14 for going to a dance, but we're still going to different places to pick people up and those kinds of things. So the cost for passenger boarding for paratransit is significantly higher than it is for fixed route. So there is a frustration and a concern by transits throughout the United States that if we don't somehow bring that cost down or find a way of reimbursing those costs better, the only alternative under the Americans with Disabilities Act is to eliminate fixed route bus service. Because if you eliminate a fixed route bus line, let's say, for example, the number 78, then you're not obligated to provide ADA paratransit within 3/4 of a mile along that route. So there's a symbiotic relationship between C-VAN and fixed route. You know, I think that C-VAN is the forces of good, whereas fixed route is the forces of evil. No, I'm just kidding. No, we really need each other. And the only way that a public transportation entity, whether or not C-TRAN, TriMet, Access, up in Pierce County or New York City, is to eliminate fixed routes. And unfortunately, there's been circumstances, like for example in Pierce Transit, where they have not had enough money that they have eliminated fixed routes, not only to save money that's associated directly with fixed route, but also to reduce their obligation under the Americans with Disabilities Act for that 3/4 of a mile service. So there's a, right now a circular that's asking transits, do you want to increase beyond doubling the cost of the fixed route? That's the upward cost that the ADA allows us to do, to something higher. And there's some advocacy groups that say, no, we don't want you to do that. People can't afford it to begin with. And that's something that you as advocates, as people that use the services, may want to think about, and whether or not you want to advocate that the ADA remains constant at no more than twice what the cost of fixed route is, or you may want to say that, well, maybe we need to look at other ways that we can gather more money for ADA paratransit. Maybe we need more money from the state to provide additional support. Again, that's totally up to you. But the circular is asking the questions, should we exceed that doubling of fare limitation that we currently have under the ADA?
Do you want me to send it out?
I think it's important for anybody and everybody to see it so they can voice their concern.
If it deleted today, when
say again?
If it deleted when I closed my computer, will you send it to me?
Sure, if I still have it. I mean, I have mixed feelings about that. My advocacy side and the knowledge that I have as a provider of service, because I know that the people that use my service are on fixed incomes, that it's very difficult for them to do it. However, at the same time, I also realize that if we don't somehow find a way to adequately fund ADA paratransit, what's going to have to happen is transits are going to have to eliminate some obligations in order to be able to do it. My program provides 3% of the total ridership of C-TRAN, but consumes about 35% of the total cost. And so at a certain point in time, you know, that dilemma is going to come. Who is the bearer of good tidings?
See you all for a good time.
Last, we have the October event update. Is Emily here?
Yes, I'm here. I think I met most of you when I first started, almost 6 months ago, so it's nice to see you all again. Thanks for having me here. I'm just going to come over here. One thing that we have is invites for you all. I'm just going to hand these out. There's two.
Just take whatever. If you know you want to stack, like, you have some?
Okay. Yeah, you gave me, you and Trish gave me some.
Okay, we gave you some. Dale, do you need any more? Do you got some?
Maybe a couple. I'll give them here.
Yeah, grab some and take what you want, just like Adriana and Marlia.
Yes, I'll bring them to the office. Yeah. Well, I feel like I was in the back and behind people, so this is a good spot to chat with everyone. So basically, I was just going to give you a quick rundown on what we've been working on since we all saw each other last, and some of you have seen in between in planning meetings, but we are on the home stretch to the exciting employer and employment celebration in October. And so my head this week has been wrapped around the videos. I had the opportunity to spend the past 3 days with Mike Ferry, the videographer, and we are making short video stories, one at New Seasons. Yesterday we were at PUD, and today at Pioneer Feeds, so right before I came here. And really, just a great opportunity. Mike's doing a fantastic job, so I'm really excited for you guys to see those. We're just getting in nominations. Trish graciously sent out reminders today, so I know some are trickling in. And next week we're going to meet as a group to review those and decide on the winners. I don't know how much I'm allowed to reveal, Mary, so cut me off if I say too much about...
No, and I will make hard copies. We'll try and get things to you electronically, and then I will have a hard copy for those of you that are reviewing the applications. So that you don't have to print out your own.
We've gotten at least one video nomination.
Yeah, one of them was a video nomination.
It should be fun, along with the written.
So an exciting thing is Jim Corey and I are going to meet next week with Kurt Warner to talk about him being the keynote. So I'm really excited. I feel like if anyone wants to give me any tips or information about his past as a football player, I know he's big, but I'm an Oregonian with not much sports information, so I feel like I need a little bit of his help before I meet him. A man named Jonathan Chase, I know I'd sent out an email to you, the board. Jonathan Chase is going to be providing the music, and anyone in the room who has an extra 10 minutes, he has a fantastic TED Talk all about music as a window into the autistic mind. He's a fantastic musician, so I think that will be a really cool thing. If anyone knows any employment providers, or anyone's in this room, we're still looking for photos of people working, because we want to encompass those for a slideshow. So we're working on getting that information, so anyone who has any photos of people working, send them my way.
Did we send something out?
Yeah.
We did. We can send a reminder. Will you email me a reminder? Or
I can send a reminder to you to that email today. Uh-huh. Yeah, great. That's okay.
Yeah.
But other than that, I think we're just...
Well, I have something more.
Okay, so that's me. Any questions?
Well, we're getting proclamations again. So right now we have one scheduled from Battleground, Vancouver, Camas, Clark County, and Ridgefield. And you all have an opportunity to sign up because they all want to know, except the county didn't seem to care whether they knew who was coming or not, but the rest of them want to know the names of the people signing up. And I know Ted isn't here, and he kind of had fun at Camas last year, so I don't mind if one of you signs Ted up for Camas.
He liked going to Vancouver as well.
He liked going.
He's a social guy. Is he going to be in the country, though? That's the question.
He's not traveling to Asia anymore. Yeah, he should be.
If you can, I'm happy to go to Richfield if you can.
Well, I have to nail down the dates because Steve Stewart gave me the wrong dates.
When is Vancouver?
6th, yeah. 10th, October 5th.
No, it's actually Clark County?
No, Vancouver.
Oh, Vancouver, yes. 5th and 7th, yeah.
October. So I just need you to sign something and.
You have a stack of these.
Yeah, and one for each?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
If Trista wants to go to all of them.
I can't, unfortunately.
Can you come to the county?
Uh-oh. Yes, I absolutely can.
Oh, the county's doing theirs in the evening?
Yeah. Oh, but that is an evening one, yeah.
Yeah, it's the first council meeting.
They're presenting the proclamation.
So are we signing up for it to be on the board?
No, you're just signing up to attend one of these, and I'll collect you when you're done. I'll sign them.
Okay. I'll email you back.
Okay, emailing me back is fine too, if you want to do that. If I don't hear from you guys tomorrow, however, I will be calling.
Still recording.
8 a.m.
So, like, Walt, I do have to find out. No. He said 25th, so I'm guessing it was 21st. All right. We have a count, yes. Yes, we're going to need to divide staff up too, because there's one in Camas at the same time as being there, I think. Yeah.
So,
yeah.
We have a center down there.
You know, I thought about asking him when he was at the BRT thing, but I have not had. I don't know Jim as well.
Okay.
You know, we met that one time and then we never pulled it off. Mm-hmm. So, and then the Kansas Post Record wants me to contact Washougal. So I do need to do that and see if I can get Washougal. I mean, we're getting quite a... I had the finished proclamation from three of them. In 24 hours.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's amazing.
And so the cat clerk had I signed up and gave it back to was 7 o'clock, right? On the 7th.
It's 6 p.m.
6 p.m.
6 p.m.
Yeah.
On the 6th.
And it'll be right at the beginning.
Yeah.
Right before the test.
Yeah.
And you can leave that.
Yeah, you can leave that.
Or you can confirm it.
Or you don't. Know. You know, it might be.
Stay in love. Get that stupid.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's it.
Any new business?
Well, it's not business, but... I was just going to introduce our visitor, and he's my new co-worker. Actually, he's my replacement, so I can move into a new position. So this is Philemon Ngari. Most recently, like 8 days ago, from Minnesota, but originally from Kenya. He'll be working with Bethesda Lutheran Communities, for whom I work, out of the Portland Regional Office, but also in our Renton program, which is growing by leaps and bounds, as a ministry consultant. So doing spiritual support for the people we provide residential support and employment supports for. And so I can talk him into living on the Vancouver side of the river so we can have him in our county. Train him up as a disability advocate. His wife and two daughters will be joining him later. I was too close to the start of school and so forth. So I want to introduce him to all of you and to this whole wonderful disability arena, which he is new to, and I have looked for great things from him. So.
Well, if there's anything we can do to help you figure out the county and things with.
You
can do that. Yeah. All right.
Thank you.
We'll give you Darla's number.
Yeah. Sherry gave him. Sherry gave him her card.
So, by the way, I appreciate it.
So I have some happy news. I know we all like happy news. So you guys probably remember about 2 years ago, I sat here at a board meeting with a little black furry thing on the table. Aubrey was our puppy number 6. And we got a call in August that Aubrey was in team training and she made what's called a pre-match, which means that likely in the following Friday or the Friday after the following Friday, she was going to graduate. And so
Canine Companions for Independence is a national organization. And so people come from all over the United States for various reasons to the Santa Rosa campus. There's campuses around the United States. And so Neil and I made arrangements to go to Santa Rosa the weekend of the 14th of August to meet Aubrey's forever family. And so we only knew one thing. We knew the person getting the dog, his name was Matthias. And we thought maybe she was going to be a skilled companion, which means she'd work with a child. And so we got down there and met Matthias and his mom and dad, which are his facilitators. So Matthias experiences Williams syndrome. He has a lot of anxiety, a lot of just different interesting social stuff too. And his parents were so relieved that Neil and I were special education teachers. They didn't have to explain anything to us and justify why he was walking off into the flowers and looking at the bees. But the really, really awesome thing about this family is that they want to stay in touch with Neil and I. And they live in Bellevue. So they live in the state of Washington.
Woo-hoo! Oh, all
and
right.
So we saw her last weekend. She saw Yessi and Padma for the first time that she's seen them in 9 months. And they're like, we've never seen her, so excited.
Oh.
And so she's got a great family. She's got a great boy. And they're going to make a real nice bond. And she's going to be his agent. And so it's cool.
So one of the CCI dogs, a former colleague of mine trained CCI dogs, and his name is Cassius, and he was placed with a woman a couple years back, and he has a Facebook page, which is fantastic.
Cassius has a
Facebook
page? The dog has a Facebook page. Cassius CCI.
Is he a facility dog then?
He works with a woman. I think he's a service dog. He works with a woman. I'll share with you the Facebook page. I don't know if you could... They probably, since it's a child, this is an adult woman whose dog, probably more.
Yeah. But we're very proud of Aubrey.
Yeah, congratulations.
Yeah.
Now we're going to have to get a new puppy.
You always need a new puppy.
Okay. Okay, so we're adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you.